Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, President Bush turns his attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict today, as Israeli leader Ehud Olmert plays a diplomatic visit to the White House, his first meeting with President Bush since Olmert became prime minister a few months ago. On the agenda, Israel's controversial plan to draw its own borders by unilaterally withdrawing from the West Bank. The White House meeting comes as feuding Palestinian factions fight for power in a battle bordering on civil war, and as the U.S. and Israel refuse to deal with Hamas, the recently elected Palestinian government, which itself has refused to recognize Israel's existence. Tensions on all sides escalated today when Israel captured the leading Hamas militant in the West Bank. He's thought to have masterminded many suicide bombings, including an attack at Hebrew University in which 5 Americans and 4 Israelis died. We'll have a report from Gaza in a moment, but first, joining us from Washington, Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. And Richard, can you just focus us here for a second, because it doesn't seem to us as if the White House has at least publicly had the Middle East conflict on the radar recently.
No, it hasn't. And partly that's obviously because of the change in power in the Israeli government. But obviously the White House has also got a lot on its plate in other parts of the world. And what they're saying here is this session is very much a getting to know you affair between President Bush and Prime Minister Olmert. They haven't met before. I think going back, the first time they met was when the president was still governor of Texas.
Yeah. Prime Minister Olmert is said to be hoping for support, perhaps even in the form of money, for his plan to withdraw from the West Bank without negotiating with Palestinians, the Israelis saying there's really no one to negotiate with, given that Hamas is in the government. The Israeli plan means that Israel will also keep some disputed Israeli settlements near Jerusalem. What's the president's expected response?
Well, this is not a new plan in a sense. You have to remember that under Sharon, under the former Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, the White House was very heavily engaged in the Gaza withdrawal, and that was obviously the first stage of these unilateral moves by Israel. And there was always, in fact, at that early stage, a reference to parts of the West Bank, especially population centers, moving into under permanent Israeli control. That was very controversial at the time, but what you're seeing here is Olmert coming up with a more detailed plan, more practicalities involved of the actual lines of the boundaries. And the White House attitude right now is, let's see what it is, let's learn more about Olmert and find out what these details are, and then come up with a public position.
But we understand that President Bush does not want there to be a unilateral decision. He wants Prime Minister Olmert to negotiate with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Is that going to be possible?
Well, the White House and the administration has suggested this repeatedly, that somehow the president, the Palestinian president, could become the interlocutor in these discussions. And sort of ignore or sidestep the elected prime minister, the Hamas and the Hamas government. That's not terribly practical for a whole host of reasons. One of them is the financial problems that you raised about the funding of the Palestinian government as well as the Palestinian economy in general. But they are trying to keep some channel open, and that would be Abbas. As far as I can see, that doesn't really get around the problem that we've had really for many, many years, since 2000, which is who controls security on the Palestinian side.
Right, and in that case, Abbas has problems of his own dealing with Hamas, which mounted its own police force last week over Abbas's objections. Israel reportedly feels that shows Abbas's weakness. But perhaps will the leaders today discuss maybe somehow helping Abbas deal with Hamas without directly supporting Hamas?
Yeah, they are trying to figure out how to do things. There's talk about direct aid going through and how to deliver that things like hospital supplies, that kind of thing. But it doesn't really deal with the basic problem about security. And in that sense, yes, the Bush administration doesn't want to see a completely unilateral solution, but as an interim measure, until there is a partner, what they call a partner to negotiate with, a partner in peace, it's the only way I think the White House and the Israeli government can see a way forward.
And meantime, President Bush is also facing some pressure from within. The House, led by House Republicans, is today debating a ban on aid and diplomatic ties to the Palestinian Authority. How big a factor is that?
You know, I think they're pushing it an open door, frankly. I don't think the administration is trying to keep open a channel. And if you talk to European diplomats, they will also tell you that it's unacceptable to deal with Hamas. A couple of European governments have run into problems with the administration for simply inviting legislators who are associated with Hamas to Scandinavian countries. And so there's a fairly common ground there. I don't think Congress is any further out than the administration on this one.
Yeah. Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, thank you.
Anytime.
And we turn now to Los Angeles Times reporter Laura King. She joins us from her home in Jerusalem. And Laura, you were in the Gaza Strip today and yesterday. There was a fierce gun battle in downtown Gaza City between these Hamas security forces and those controlled by the Palestinian Authority, President Abbas. What's been the fallout? How are people feeling today about that really horrific gun battle?
Well, today was a little bit of a hangover from that, I think. I would say the atmosphere was very tense, but somewhat calmer, and it appears that the leaders of the various factions have been trying very hard to keep a lid on things. They held some talks today among themselves, and it seems that word might have gone out to their forces on the street to really avoid any kind of an armed confrontation like the one that took place yesterday.
Well, because, you know, good news in that others were saying that this might have been the tipping point toward what people fear is a possible civil war. And the head of Hamas, the Prime Minister Haniyeh, has said that the word civil war doesn't even exist in the Palestinian dictionary. But is there a fear that this power struggle could devolve into that?
There is. There's a very real fear, and he was speaking figuratively, of course. But there is a very real fear, and it just is not clear at this point whether it has tipped over into that territory. But certainly a display like yesterday in the middle of Gaza City with many civilians around fleeing in real terror. Is just a real sign of anarchy.
There are supposed to be talks between the factions this week. We wonder, first of all, will they go ahead? And is it, you know, as in perhaps other countries, a situation where it's not just those two factions anymore? There seem to be other players in the violence. We read about armed gangs and other militias. Is it that widespread?
Well, particularly in Gaza, there are many factions involved. Even Fatah itself has splintered into many subgroups, some of which are actually aligning themselves with Hamas. And so it's complicated, and it's not simply a matter of two parties sitting down. It's more like, you know, maybe half a dozen main organizations at this point sitting down and trying to work something out. And there's a strong motivation on the part of Hamas to keep some kind of control and stability, and probably the ones who are more interested in making trouble at this point are the forces of Fatah, who were defeated in the parliamentary elections in January.
Laura, you talked about the sheer terror yesterday, but what else is going on the ground for Palestinians, especially with the cutoff of so much aid?
Well, that is a major theme, to some extent in the West Bank and to a greater extent in Gaza, of just daily hardship really, really growing. I mean, people have been, government workers, most of whom support a large extended family, have been without salaries for more than 2 months now. People are selling jewelry and family heirlooms in order to be able to buy food. It would be an exaggeration to say that there's starvation or malnutrition or anything like that at this point, but certainly the most vulnerable are really feeling the effects of this, you know, the elderly, the handicapped, and Gaza was a very poor place to begin with, so it's not as if they can handle a lot more by way of economic hardship.
Laura King, Jerusalem-based correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Laura, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, joining us now from New York, Middle East analyst Aaron David Miller. He's a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. He served as an advisor on Arab-Israeli negotiations for the last six secretaries of state. And Aaron, we were just talking about, you know, the aid to the Palestinian government. The U.S. stance has been to cut off aid, as, you know, the stance of other countries as well. You write that it's not workable. Why? I mean, European Union negotiators are trying to find a middle ground. Is their solution any better?
Well, no, I mean, I think there is a workable strategy. It's just that we have to be extremely careful. On one hand, we cannot empower Hamas. After all, this is an organization that, without candidacy requirements, used a democratic process to get into a leadership position while not abandoning it, its policy, avowed policy of destroying, literally destroying another UN member state, Israel. So we can't empower Hamas. But by the same token, we cannot punish the vast majority of the Palestinian public for exercising a democratic process and an election, which the United States pushed very hard to hold, and the government of Israel acquiesced in. So the issue is, can you deal not only with humanitarian requirements, but can you deal with the 150,000, 60,000 Palestinians who have not been paid for several months through a process which is accountable and transparent and doesn't empower Hamas? And that, it seems to me, is one of the ideas that the Europeans are playing with. And it seems to me, and the Israelis, I think, have accepted the reality that even their $50 million a month in terms of VAT and tax revenue needs a channel needs to be found to get that aid to Palestinians. So I think there are workable ideas. I do not believe that our strategy of making Hamas fail in the eyes of the Palestinian public, frankly, is going to succeed. They're going to likely blame the United States and the Israelis way before they blame their own leaders.
Well, is unilateralism the solution? As we just heard Richard Wolff say, that the Bush administration, even though it's asking for negotiations, is sort of resigned to the fact that that may be the only way to go. Do you agree?
Well, unilateralism is a default position. I mean, sadly, unfortunately, even tragically, right now, the environment that characterizes the Israeli-Palestinian relationship is one that I would say is based on the four no's. There's no negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. There's no trust between Israelis and Palestinians. There's no governing framework that regulates or addresses the needs and requirements of Israelis and Palestinians. And there's no outside mediator, and namely the United States, who at this point seems willing and able to deal with a bilateral negotiating process. So unilateralism is really the default position, with certain conditions, and I think the Prime Minister will hear some of them, I suspect, in Washington today. With certain conditions, unilateralism could actually be an effective strategy.
Well, we read, former CIA Chief James Woolsey writes in today's Wall Street Journal that the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza last summer left that area in chaos, and that there would be the same result in the West Bank if Israel unilaterally pulled out from there. So he makes the point that Palestinians need to just have as much respect for Israelis living in their area as Israelis do of Palestinians in Israel proper. We only have about a minute left, and I know that's a big chunk of thought there, but you know, is that a possible solution, just somehow waiting it out?
Look, the government of Israel has made a decision. Ariel Sharon, who was the principal architect of the idea of Greater Israel, through unilateral disengagement from Gaza, literally killed the idea of Greater Israel, killed it economically, politically, and psychologically. And it is now up to the current Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, by his own choice, to bury that idea. And the way it's going to be buried is through further unilateral steps. Now, maybe on the West Bank, those unilateral steps may be civilian in nature. Maybe they will not include Israeli military withdrawal or disengagement. But there's no question that it is only a matter of time before the Israelis begin to vacate significant areas of the West Bank.
Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, also advisor to six secretaries of state. Aaron, thanks for helping us put this back on the table, and we'll continue this discussion another time. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Well, just ahead, where's your personal information if you're a vet? Much more coming up here and now. It's here and now.
Welcome to 1-800-FED-INFO.
If you are calling about the recent theft of Veterans Affairs electronic data, please listen to the following message. We believe this theft was a random act and not a deliberate attempt to steal information about veterans.
That's a message on the Department of Veterans Affairs' new toll-free number set up to do damage control after personal data on millions of vets was stolen. The VA says an electronic data file containing the names, birth dates, and social security numbers of 26.5 million veterans was stolen. An employee reportedly violated restrictions and brought the file home to do some work. Then the file and the computer it was on was stolen during a burglary. The theft is the largest unauthorized release of social security numbers ever, and it has veterans around the country worried that they could become the victims of identity theft. Well, we'll find out more about how that information was stolen in a moment, but first, we turn to Joe Davis, a spokesperson for Veterans of Foreign Wars. And Joe, you're a vet yourself of the first Gulf War and Somalia. What was your reaction, your personal reaction, when you heard about this alleged theft?
Good morning, Robin. My first reaction, along with probably every veteran out there, was just utter shock. Mm-hmm. How could a government organization that, tasked with being the lead veterans advocate for the entire country inadvertently have this incident happen? It's just outrageous.
Well, there reportedly has been criticism of the VA's ability to keep information private.
And it's rightful criticism as well. I mean, you know, when you're charged with this type of private information, whether it's a tacit approval or just blatant, I'm taking this work home to work on it, you just don't do that stuff. And along with, our primary goal right now is the notification of all the veterans. And second is we want accountability.
Well, and what are you hearing from your members?
They're outraged. And especially, there's a lot of concern for the older veterans out there who may not be internet savvy and know how to go on to the different credit agencies that can check their score.
Well, and tell us, what is it that veterans are supposed to do now?
Well, first of all, obviously the VA is going to be sending out letters to every single veteran that's impacted by this to explain. But, we know how fast the mail is going to go through. But what we're asking every veteran out there and those, the children of veterans, of older veterans, is to get with your parents get onto these different credit score lines and start checking. Because, the key to the empire is a Social Security number. And when you have a name, you got the social, you got the date of birth, and in some cases a home address, spousal information, you've got everything you need. So we're also asking for the credit card companies to be alert to this, because this isn't a credit for new applications coming from people with existing credit cards. This isn't the application that's coming in the mail to your house unsolicited. This is a new application that's coming in the mail to the credit card company.
Right, with all this information on it, people looking for credit.
Absolutely.
Right, and by the way, we should say apparently the information on the disc includes anyone discharged after 1975 and some of their spouses, as well as some veterans discharged before 75.
That. That's right, if they had filed a claim with the veteran.
Yeah.
So that would mean the World War II, Korean, and definitely the Vietnam generation.
Right. Well, and you say you want accountability. What do you mean by that? There's an investigation apparently pending.
There are regulations and quite possibly laws broken here. What the VA secretary said yesterday is this data analyst did not have the authority to take this information home. Okay, that's a regulation, an in-house regulation, obviously, that has been broken. Now, if this employee had the tacit approval, a head nod, from his supervisors to take this work home, and we all know that the federal government is really big on telecommuting. So if he had the approval from his supervisors, we want their jobs too. They should all be terminated. There is no second chance for this type of grievous offense.
Joe Davis, spokesperson for Veterans of Foreign Wars. Joe, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Well, for more on the stolen data, we turn to Christopher Lee, who's been covering the story for The Washington Post. Chris, we just heard veterans are angry. They want people to lose jobs. Will the employee who took this information home be fired?
It's hard to say. We asked Secretary Nicholson that the other day, and he said that we could imagine his feelings on the subject, but that we had to wait until the investigations were done.
Yeah. Well, another thing that's fueling anger is that apparently this theft was first reported May 3rd. In other words, the military knew about it. We're just finding out about it now. Why the delay? Because, veterans are saying this information could already have been used to steal identities.
Right. Well, what the VA officials told us yesterday is that they were going back and forth, sort of an internal debate about whether they should release the information, because one argument is that if it's on the front page of the newspaper, as it is today, and all over television, then you're telling the thieves what they have. If it was a garden variety burglary, perhaps all they wanted to do was sell the laptop.
Well, and in fact, what are the chances that this was a garden variety burglary? We read that a window was cracked open and a computer taken. But, we spoke to many veterans earlier today, and they're already coming up with, conspiracy theories.
Right, and I wish I could give them answers, and I'm sure the VA does too. You might think about it this way, though: if an employee intended to have this data stolen, intended to sell this data to someone, I don't think that he or she would then report the theft of the laptop to the police. More likely, they would take it home, have it copied, sell it, bring the information back to work, and pretend it, like nothing happened. Having said that, though, even if it was a garden variety burglary, once these thieves realize what they have, they can always sell it to someone who knows how to use it.
Or if they're, knuckleheads and wouldn't know how to do that, they could conceivably return the file somehow.
Right.
Well, the VA has set up a toll-free number. They tell people there's no reason to believe that the stolen information will be misused. But as we've been saying, it has Social Security numbers, birth dates, and names, which is like a kit for identity theft. So what more can the government do to help monitor the situation?
In the corporate world, when this happens, when corporations have violated their own policies and given up personal information of their customers, they've often offered to help their customers track their credit reports and credit scores and credit card accounts, and usually that involves some financial assistance. Now, we asked the Secretary yesterday whether that would be forthcoming for veterans, and that yesterday he said that they hadn't discussed that, but I have a feeling that 26 million veterans are up in arms about what happened. They're a politically powerful group, and if they need some assistance in tracking this, I think that if anyone has the leverage to get it out of the government, it's them.
In the meantime, just, you know, we've touched on it, but what should veterans do that you've discovered?
Well, basically, the most fundamental thing is to keep an eye on your credit card accounts, see if there's any unusual purchases. Make sure you keep track of your bank statements, you know what's in there. You can also alert credit monitoring companies and ask them to see if a credit card account is taken out across the country from where you live.
And hopefully credit card companies will start to notice if suddenly things appear on cards of people that don't normally. Christopher Lee of The Washington Post speaking to us about the theft of the personal data of 26.5 million American veterans. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes Here and Now. They're still cleaning up from last year's Gulf Coast storms, but the 2006 hurricane season is only about a week away, and most forecasters are predicting a very active season. They say it won't be as bad as last year when there were so many storms, 27, that forecasters ran out of names, and there were 15 hurricanes in all. But forecasters say there will be an above-average level of hurricane activity this year. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration outlined its initial forecast for the season yesterday. For the most part, it's consistent with the prediction from another one of the country's leading hurricane forecasters, the Tropical Meteorology Project at Colorado State University. Phil Klotzbach is with the project. He joins us now on the line to talk about what's ahead. Phil, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And your hurricane forecast is officially released next week, but we understand it will predict that the 2006 season will be more active than average, right?
Well, certainly. We have actually issued two predictions already. Our last prediction came out on the 4th of April, and in that prediction we called for 17 named storms, 9 hurricanes, and 5 major hurricanes, which are the category 3, 4, and 5 storms in the Saffir-Simpson scale. Our next forecast, as you said, mentioned, does go out next week. It goes out next Wednesday, May 31st, to coincide with the start of the hurricane season on June 1st. And we're still working on the final numbers, but we don't see any major changes in our numbers.
And that's pretty much like NOAA's prediction yesterday. They said 13 to 16 named storms with 4 to 6 hurricanes. First of all, how accurate, you know, is this business of forecasting?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's hard to give one number for that because it's kind of how you keep score. But basically, you can't obviously say exactly that there's going to be, say, 17 storms this year. I mean, sometimes you might actually be right. But generally, what you can say, especially by our end of our May forecast, is kind of give a gradation as to, say, for example, 17, 9, and 5 that we're predicting is a very active season, about twice the average season.
And by the way, how did you do last year, just to give us a sense?
Our late May forecast last year was for about 170% of an average season. So we called for a very active season, although nobody that I'm aware of was able to predict the fact that we'd have nearly 2.5 to 3 times what you would expect in an average season.
Right.
So we did pretty well, but obviously we didn't forecast quite the amount of activity that occurred.
Well, there are different schools of thought as to why the seasons have been so active, and they're projected to be active for about 20 years out, I understand. Why is that?
Well, in general, the Atlantic, if you go back and look at the data from the past, if you can get data back to about the 1860s or so, and the Atlantic tends to go through periods of about 25 to 30 years where you have a lot of storms, and then about 25 to 30 years where you have many fewer storms. And it's just to be interesting to note also that during the last inactive period, and then from 95 to 2003 where we had many fewer landfalls, there was a huge coastal population shift. So now with the last 2 years of landfalls, there's obviously a lot more population in harm's way than there was, say, 35, 40 years ago.
And by the way, that's, we understand one thing you really are less good at predicting is the landfall.
Well, certainly, landfall is governed a lot more by the day-to-day weather, and we find you can say, for example, this year looks more like an East Coast year or a Gulf Coast year or maybe more a year like the late 90s or like 95 where most of the storms recurved before making landfall.
We're here in the Boston area, of course. We're, you know, looking at our coast, and we're hearing that, you know, maybe there's a chance of a major hurricane hitting the northeastern U.S.
Well, certainly, I mean, there's always a chance. The average probability based on data from the 20th century of a major hurricane making landfall in, say, southern New England and Long Island is about 5%. And this year our probability was about 9%. So, again, the probability is nearly twice what it is in an average year. However, that's still about a 1 in 10 chance.
I'm sure all forecasters have been looking closely at the Gulf region where, for instance, in New Orleans, who knows if the levees there are capable of taking another hit. So what is your sense of that region?
Well, I mean, in terms of, you know, if that area is vulnerable, I mean, it's certainly vulnerable. I mean, it's a low-lying coastal area. In general, being able to tell whether storms are going to hit the East Coast in terms of, say, the general steering flow is easier to predict than the Gulf Coast. Gulf Coast storms don't necessarily form from waves moving off the coast of Africa. Occasionally, they'll form from cold fronts moving into the Gulf of Mexico and other means, which makes those storms tougher to predict.
And back to the reasons for this. I mean, you explained that there's a sort of natural rhythm to the Earth, it seems. But some are also saying that there's a particularly violent sort of formation of elements, water and wind. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, the last couple of years especially, we've seen a combination of warm ocean temperatures, which are important, but also we've seen very low amounts of what's called vertical wind shear. And basically, wind shear is winds at different levels in the atmosphere blowing from different directions. If you have strong wind shear, it basically is like it tears apart the system. You have winds at high up pulling a storm one way and winds low down pulling it the other, so it kind of gets torn apart. In the last couple of years, we've seen very low vertical wind shear, and then we've seen a lot of major hurricanes develop.
Where do you fall in the debate over how much human activity has made hurricanes more powerful?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. I had a paper published last weekend in Geophysical Research Letters where I took a look at the data, and over the last 20 years where the data is the best, we've actually seen very little to no trend in the Category 4 or 5 hurricanes, the most intense storms, as well as an integrated measure of energy generated by tropical cyclones. So at this point, we don't think you really can – you can't say that it isn't having an effect, but you really can't say from the data that it is having an effect either. I think that's still a question open for debate.
How about the number of storms?
Well, I think I've yet to see a study that shows anything about the number of storms increasing around the globe. Certainly in the Atlantic, they're increasing compared with, say, storms in the 50s and 60s, but a lot of that's likely due to just improved technology that we have now.
So you're saying you don't see the data now that human-driven global warming has anything to do with hurricanes, but it's undoubtedly true that warmer oceans do increase, make for stronger storms.
Well, certainly in the Atlantic that is the case, but however, if you look around the globe, that's not necessarily the case, because in the Atlantic, when sea surface temperatures are warmer, you tend to have much less vertical wind shear, and if you actually separate out those two factors, vertical wind shear is much more important.
So, overall, what's your main message to people this hurricane season?
Well, now is really the time to prepare and to have a plan. If you live along the coastline, you need to think about what you're going to do if a hurricane does threaten. Have a plan in place now, and then certainly if a storm does threaten and your watch or warning is issued, to heed the necessary warnings from the emergency managers.
Phil Klotzbach, he's with the Tropical Meteorology Project at Colorado State University. Phil, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we have a brief acknowledgement. Former Senator, Treasury Secretary, and one-time Vice Presidential candidate Lloyd Benson died today. Although Benson served in Congress for more than two dozen years, he's probably best remembered for his comment in the 1988 Vice Presidential candidate debate with then-Senator Dan Quayle. Dan Quayle said that he had as much experience in Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. Here's that now famous comeback from Lloyd Benson.
I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
At that time, Benson was Michael Dukakis' running mate. Their ticket lost to the Bush-Quayle ticket in 40 states. Lloyd Benson died today at his home in Houston. He was 85. You're listening to Here and Now. So now you tell us. For many sleep-deprived parents, one of the most popular approaches to getting a baby to sleep was to tough it out and let the little one cry it out. The recommendation came from Dr. Richard Ferber, the man who started the world's first pediatric sleep clinic at Children's Hospital here in Boston. And parents who followed it were said to be Ferberizing their babies. Well, now Dr. Ferber has a new book out, and he's trying to put his own theory to bed. Here and Now's Alan Cockle has more.
Ferberize, a verb. To allow a baby to cry for increasing periods until he or she learns to fall asleep without physical comforting from a parent. From a method described in a 1985 book by Dr. Richard Ferber of Children's Hospital in Boston.
Concept that some people are implying that I have this approach that I use for children who are not sleeping well is a complete misunderstanding.
Rightly or wrongly, for two decades, Richard Ferber's name has been attached to the idea that any and every child would quickly learn to sleep through the night if parents just left them to cry for a few nights. Many parents swear by his method. Some consider it just short of barbaric.
So what would you say your goal is at this point?
But in his clinic, Ferber comes across as gentle. He's a slight, soft-spoken man with wire-rimmed glasses and a closely trimmed gray beard.
You want a kiss? Mwah.
With him are Beth and her 2-year-old son, Gabriel, who can't seem to fall asleep without one of his parents lying beside him.
My goal, I really want to find a solution to the whole having to lie down with him on the futon.
If you're going to end up on the futon with him, you might as well just go there from the beginning. Mm-hmm. If we really want to make a major, major effort at getting away from that, then Gabriel needs to have experience doing that, not just once in a while. The way it works is if he does it night after night after night, he starts to forget about the old way and remembers the new way.
Ferber's consultations mix sleep science with psychology. On this, he says his views haven't changed. His goal is to help parents find their own solution. The so-called Ferber method, the approach of allowing a child to cry for longer and longer periods, he reserves only for those families who want to break what Ferber calls bad sleep habits.
A typical example of that is a child who is rocked to sleep. The family is sneaking them into the crib and then tiptoeing out of the room. So when they wake up at night, lo and behold, everything has been changed. Now that child is not going to be very happy with that. If the family wants the youngster sleeping in the crib by themselves, then they have to be honest with their youngster, and you put the child into the crib awake.
What I see is the baby's pretty much shut down.
This is Dr. Bob Sears, co-author with his father William Sears of another new baby sleep book. The Sears are opposed to letting children cry themselves to sleep, which Bob Sears says can cause neurological and psychological damage.
They don't laugh as spontaneously. They don't coo and babble as often. They kind of turn into pretty quiet babies, and we call it the shutdown syndrome.
Sears admits he only sees this in babies who've been crying for long periods, week after week, something Richard Ferber does not advocate. Ferber says his experience with thousands of patients convinces him that the best way to a happy baby is to make sure everyone gets a good night's sleep. But there is an area where both Sears and Ferber have changed their views. 20 years ago, the Sears were strong advocates of co-sleeping, the practice of parents and children sharing a bed. In their new book, the Sears acknowledge that this doesn't work for everybody. Ferber once said that parents who want to co-sleep should, quote, examine their own motivations. In his new book, he now says co-sleeping works just fine for many families.
Children are very flexible. They can sleep well in many different settings and do terrifically.
As for the verb Ferberize, the doctor says he'd just as soon it went to sleep.
That's Here and Now's Alan Cockle. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now. It seems you see the country girl group the Dixie Chicks everywhere lately, on the cover of Time Magazine, on 60 Minutes, but you won't see them tonight on the stage at the Academy of Country Music Awards show. As reporter Peter Cooper writes in the online news service Tennessean.com, the Dixie Chicks and Country Radio filed for joint separations 3 years ago. That's when, just before the invasion of Iraq, singer Natalie Maines famously criticized President Bush from a London stage, saying, "We're ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas." Well, country stations responded by pulling their songs. That backlash knocked them off their perch as the biggest-selling female group in music history. They received serious death threats, and they were booed at concerts. The Chicks made a half-hearted apology, but now they're even taking that back. The new Dixie Chicks CD is called Taking the Long Way, and just about every song, including the new single Not Ready to Make Nice, refers unapologetically to what they call the incident. Chicks are taking a gamble, thumbing their nose at the red state radio stations and music fans who made them. It's not exactly a huge risk. One industry analyst says if the Chicks lose half their fan base and sell only half as many albums, they'll still outsell every other country act. But it's not like rock and roll, where criticizing the president has meant soaring sales for artists like Bruce Springsteen, Green Day, and Kanye West. The Dixie Chicks are furthest out on the country limb, but they're not alone. Here Now's music critic Tim Riley has been listening to another country music legend asking for an end to war.
God bless the army and God bless our liberty. Jack gum the rest of it all. Hit a man in position of backing away. Freedom is stuck in reverse. Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first.
That's Merle Haggard from his new album, Chicago Wind. Tim, can this be Merle Haggard, the same guy who brought us Okie from Muskogee in the late 60s, the pro-war anthem?
This is the same guy, and part of what's going on here is that people were always a bit too eager to read too much into Okie from Muskogee, which wasn't necessarily pro-war, but it was really Nixon's silent majority. Hey, there's a lot of regular folks out here who just really do not get what the hippie thing is all about. It's interesting how the planets have kind of aligned here, because Merle Haggard has sort of taken on this larger symbolism, like Johnny Cash and Dolly Parton. Throughout most of the 90s, he was on independent labels cutting Roots Records and doing some really great work. But the Nashville establishment really was not embracing him. And now he's back on Capitol Records, where he enjoyed 38 number one country and western hits back in the day. And he sounds great, and he's got some topical songs on this new record of his. It's his first record of new material for Capitol in over two decades.
Well, let's listen to another song. It's just called Where's All the Freedom?
Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for? Is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him his new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
Okay, let's compare this to Merle Haggard's Fight Inside of Me.
I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside of me.
Tim Wright, what's happened here? Is Merle Haggard one of those people who is, well, he's certainly not anti-war, but is he one of those who's now saying he's against the war in Iraq just because it's going poorly?
No, I really don't think that's what's happening. I think it's actually more complicated and interesting, and it's actually a very good, subtle rebuttal to the way the right wing would like to frame the whole debate. You know, country music has never been that easy to pigeonhole. You know, people would like to think of it as just a great big land of rednecks, you know, beer drinking people who sing about honky-tonking and cheating and sleeping around and all that stuff. And country music has always been much more complicated and interesting than that. For example, that Fight Inside of Me song, Toby Keith is now singing that at his concerts as a real sort of gung-ho piece of jingoism. And Toby Keith is pretty emphatically pro-war, but he's using this Merle Haggard song, and he's written a couple extra new verses. And I was talking to Merle Haggard's publicist, and she said, oh, yeah, they're really good friends now. But it's very clear they're on very different sides of the political spectrum. So what's getting expressed in country music is actually, you know, some of the central cultural tensions alive in America today, which is as it should be. It's a music that's expressing the different kinds of opinions and lifestyles and attitudes that are happening and alive in culture.
And we should point out Merle Haggard isn't coming late to this party, if you will. He actually defended the Dixie Chicks and was against the invasion of Iraq.
Yeah, well, the minute President Bush declared mission accomplished, Merle Haggard came out and said, hey, you know, I'm with the Dixie Chicks, and this is ridiculous to say that this thing is over. It's not over. So Merle Haggard really did come from Bakersfield, and he's part of that Buck Owens sort of anti-Nashville sort of country style. They were doing stuff that the country establishment didn't like and wasn't approving of. They see themselves as like not really of a piece with the Nashville establishment.
Merle Haggard was an Okie. He was transplanted to California by the Depression. He was in prison. He first heard Johnny Cash in prison.
A chronic juvenile delinquent, many stints in prison. The famous story about him saying to Johnny Cash, you know, I heard you at San Quentin. And Johnny Cash said, I don't remember you being on that bill. And he said, no, I was in the audience. I was a prisoner, you know. He really does have this wreckage from the past, you know.
Well, and speaking of the past, there are going to be reissues of some of his old records. You say grab them if you can.
Yeah, now is an excellent time to run out and buy these Capitol reissues of Merle Haggard, because who knows how long they're going to stay in print.
Okay, so we know Merle Haggard, huge influence on country music. And he shows up on a new Gretchen Wilson video, Politically Uncorrect. She's country's newest model for the working class heroine, as some have said, one for the Walmart crowd. She refers to herself and Merle as me and old hag.
I'm for the farmer, dirt on his hands, and the soldiers who fight for this land.
Now here, it sounds like Wilson is casting Haggard in her right-wing point of view.
That's definitely what's going on here. Wilson's version of Bible, home, and patriotism is a lot more soft-core than Merle Haggard's. She has images of soldiers in her video, but it's not exactly pro-war either. And, of course, Merle Haggard's happy to be co-opted, I think, because he wants her audience and doesn't have any trouble agreeing with her, you know, vaguer list of generalities.
Tim Riley, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Robin.
That's right. Half the world already knows where I stand.
Here Now, music critic Tim Riley on Merle Haggard with Gretchen Wilson here in the background. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.